This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Against the dramatic backdrop of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, President Bush will announce an end to major combat operations in Iraq about 6 hours from now. Earlier today, with less fanfare, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld made a similar statement about Afghanistan during a visit to Kabul. While the president will praise the troops that won the battle in Iraq and talk about the transition to reconstruction, he is not expected to declare victory. By the yardstick that administration officials laid out before the war, there is much left undone. Most of the top Iraqi leadership, including Saddam Hussein, is still at large, and U.S.-led forces have yet to uncover any weapons of mass destruction. Civil unrest continues in some places. Many others still lack basic services like water and electricity, and while preliminary meetings on the formation of a transitional government are underway, that is a long way from the establishment of a democratic government. Later in the program, we'll discuss the development and the prospects of the newly released roadmap to peace in the Middle East, but first we'll explore what it would take to complete a victory in Iraq. Do you think it's crucial to capture Saddam or uncover chemical weapons, or has the United States already achieved victory by toppling Saddam's government? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us is Walter Russell Mead, Senior Fellow of U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us by phone from his office in New York City. Good of you to be back on Talk of the Nation.
It's good to be here.
Also with us is John Mearsheimer, co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He joins us from the studio on the University of Chicago's campus, and it's good to have you back as well, sir.
Pleased to be here, Neil.
Walter Russell Mead, let's begin with you. How much distance do you think there is between here and VI Day? What's left undone?
Well, in one sense, we have enough of a military victory. We have a political victory for the Bush administration, I think, at this point, which they will keep if they don't lose it. But if we think about getting to our definition of victory is a stable Iraq, the ability of the U.S. to reduce its presence there, the acceptance of what's happened in Iraq by the rest of the world community, we're still some ways away.
John Mearsheimer?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's no question that the United States won a significant military victory. It was something of an unfair fight. Nobody ever doubted that we would defeat the Iraqi army and topple Saddam's regime. But to declare victory, you have to win a broader political victory. And what that means, I think, is putting in place a government in Iraq that would allow us to leave. And such a government would have to meet three criteria. Number one, it would have to be capable of providing stability for the Iraqi people. Number two, it would have to be friendly to the United States. And number three, it would have to be a government that would not pursue weapons of mass destruction after we left. Mm-hmm. And putting such a government into place so that we can leave, I believe, is going to be extremely difficult to do. We may accomplish it, but I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it.
You were both talking about political terms. As Saddam's power has collapsed in Iraq, more and more information has come out about the extent of the brutality of his regime. Given that, would you think that there is a moral victory simply by liberating the Iraqi people? Walter Russell Mead?
I think the United States looks a lot better than it did and probably will continue to. It's a way, sort of the way that when Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago came out, there were a lot of people who previously had seen a kind of a moral equivalence between the U.S. and the USSR that changed their view, and something similar may be at work here, too. I think, though, that it's going to be important to have more evidence than we've now shown of weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq. I think those two things together would significantly enhance the victory that we've achieved so far.
John Mearsheimer, you were you described the war ahead of time as unnecessary. You opposed it. Do you think that on that moral question, do you think weapons of mass destruction are critical?
Well, I think there's no question that the reason that we went to war was because the Bush administration convinced the American people that Saddam represented an imminent threat, both in terms of his conventional weapons and his purported weapons of mass destruction. I think it's quite clear, after watching the stunning victory we won against Iraq, and then noticing that we have not been able to discover any weapons of mass destruction, that he was not an imminent threat to the United States. Even if we discover some weapons of mass destruction or a program pointing in that direction, in no way, shape, or form is he an imminent threat. In fact, North Korea is a much more imminent threat to the United States than Iraq, and it still boggles my mind that we invaded Iraq and concentrated on Iraq rather than North Korea.
The issue of weapons of mass destruction critical not only here, perhaps, but also in Britain, where, of course, Prime Minister Tony Blair was the other principal member of what the administration liked to call the coalition. Yesterday in the House of Commons, Conservative member Peter Tapsell asked Prime Minister Blair about the possibility that no weapons of mass destruction would be found. And let's listen to the tape.
It eventually transpires that at the time of our invasion, Iraq no longer possessed weapons of mass destruction capable of threatening this country, and that the Prime Minister led this country into war on a false assumption. Will he resign?
Forgive me if I've refused to engage in all sorts of speculations and will refuse to engage in them now. But let me say to him, I am absolutely convinced and confident about the case on weapons of mass destruction. And I simply suggest to him and others who believe somehow that this was all a myth invented by us, I would refer them, first of all, to the 12 years of United Nations reports detailing exactly what weapons of mass destruction were held by the then Iraqi regime. And we are now, in a deliberative way and in a considered way, investigating the various sites, and we will bring forward the analysis of the results of that investigation in due course. And I think when we do so, the Honourable Gentleman and others will be eating some of their words.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair yesterday in the House of Commons. Walter Russell Mead, what about John Mearsheimer's point that even if at this point substantial quantities are found, they clearly weren't ready for use, they didn't represent an immediate threat?
Well, I don't actually think that we made the danger from North Korea worse by going first on Iraq. It may be that what the administration did was it sensed that Iraq might be the easier one and wanted to get that out of the way and then deal with North Korea in a from a position of greater strength. But I think I hear what Tony Blair said, and I assume that he must feel that he has some grounds for that confidence. There's a kind of a tendency of the Bush administration to lurk and pounce, you know, to sort of let critics have a field day and build up great theories, you know, the invasion of Baghdad will be like Mogadishu and thousands will die, and sort of commit themselves to all kinds of scenarios and cases. And then sort of when that's built up at a certain point, they end up kind of making the critics look very silly. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see something like this on weapons of mass destruction, though obviously it's a little too early to tell.
It is. We shall see, perhaps. John Mearsheimer, I hear you wanted to get in there.
Yeah, let me make two quick points. One is, I don't understand how Tony Blair can be absolutely confident that they have weapons of mass destruction. That statement conveys that he knows where they are and he knows how many there are. And if that were the case, he could point us in the right direction. The fact is, we don't know what they have. And we may find some weapons, but then again, we may not. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think if you look at the Bush administration's rhetoric on this issue, it's very different than Tony Blair's. The Bush administration is beginning to backpedal, and they're beginning to say, well, even if they don't have chemical and biological weapons, it's probably because they got rid of them, or at least we know that they had plans to build those weapons and so forth and so on. But you don't see the kind of confidence coming from the Bush administration that we're going to find these weapons that you see coming from Tony Blair.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Alan, who joins us on the line from Fairfield, Iowa.
Yes, I think that the premises and the pretext for the war really must not be allowed to slide. The first premise and pretext for this war in Iraq was that we had had a major attack by foreign terrorists on 9/11. And, of course, you've already discussed, so I don't need to make that point so much, that the weapons of mass destruction, are not yet in evidence. And, if we were to go into every dictatorship around the world who was as terrible as Saddam Hussein, we'd probably have a long list. And I don't think that that's appropriate foreign policy, and I don't think that the United States the people of the United States would stand for it. But there's a point that the media has really completely left unexamined, and that is the facts about 9/11 that call into question as to whether or not it was reported accurately. For example, World Trade Center number 7, the lower building, there were two huge towers, and there was World Trade Center number 7.
Mm-hmm.
That fell first before the South Tower collapsed. After the airplanes hit the South and the North Towers, but before the South Tower fell, World Trade Center number 7 collapsed in what was obviously a controlled demolition. It all came down at once. There was a huge explosion of smoke.
I hear a grassy knoll.
I'm not sure that's right, Alan.
I have the videos. They show that there's a straight-on video looking toward the North Tower with the World Trade Center number 7, and it just comes down in a straightforward collapse. Then I have another video that's from the side. It shows a huge cloud of smoke rising up where the World Trade Center number 7 was, but you can't see the building because it's not angled like that.
Alan, if you're right, you do have something that's very important, and I'd like to see the videos, but until I do...
Email, can I send them to you?
Sure, yeah. TOTN at NPR.org. That's our email address.
I'm sorry, say it again.
TOTN at NPR.org.
Okay, and to your attention?
Sure.
I will do it.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Bye. But Alan does at least raise a point, and that is another big reason cited before the war was ties to terrorism, terrorists, if not Al Qaeda, certainly to others. Has that breaking up those Walter Russell Mead, is that something that has been vindicated yet?
Well, my view was that the real connection between Saddam Hussein and September 11th was that. As long as Saddam Hussein was violating the ceasefire agreements and staying armed and a threat to his neighbors, the U.S. had to keep troops in Saudi Arabia. It was the presence of Saudi troops. You go back and you read what Osama bin Laden has written and what others have written about him. That was the issue that caused him to break with the Saudi government and establishment and move into on the terror path. And the presence of U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia was enormously destabilizing in the region and a real problem for religious Muslims, and rightly so.
And they have been announced that they will be largely withdrawn by
exactly.
the end of the summer.
So I think what we're seeing is that the removal of Saddam Hussein is already beginning to help deal with the root causes of terrorism, and I think it's very important.
Yet, very quickly, John Mearsheimer, there were certainly a lot of allegations about ties to Al-Qaeda.
There were all sorts of allegations. In fact, 42% of the American people in February of this year believed that Iraq, Saddam Hussein in particular, was directly involved in the World Trade Center bombings, despite the fact that there was zero evidence to support that.
And no allegation of that from the administration.
That's correct. No direct allegation of that, but it was implied time after time. I think the Bush administration did a brilliant job of convincing a large chunk of the American people that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were tied at the hip, despite the fact that it was hardly any evidence to support that.
We're talking about different ways to divine victory in Iraq, and we're taking your calls. We'll take more of them when we come back from a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address again, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little later in the show, we'll talk about the newly released Roadmap for Peace in the Middle East. Are the chances for this peace process any better than the one that started after the last Gulf War? Right now, we'll continue our discussion about victory and the war in Iraq. What measures do you use to define success? Have any of your ideas about the role of the U.S. in the region changed over the course of the war? Our guests are Walter Russell Mead, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, and John Mearsheimer, Co-Director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. Of course, you're invited to join our discussion. 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255, and TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go now to Andrew, who's on the line from San Francisco.
Yes, I'm wondering what our timetable is for establishing a democratic government in Iraq, given that never in U.S. history has the United States ever directly militarily intervened in any developing country for the purposes of establishing a democracy. And if either of your guests believe that the U.S. ever has, I would like them to name such a country. We were after bin Laden, and we lost him. We were after Mullah Omar, and we lost him. We were after the Taliban, and we lost them. That only left us with al-Qaeda, and we rounded up about 2,000 grunts, but nobody at the top, meaning Mullah Omar or bin Laden. So we put in our hand-picked puppets, and we have to pay off the local warlords not to kill him. And we killed thousands of innocent civilians in the process, and ordinary women in Afghanistan are no more meaningfully free now than they were before. So I would have to say that our campaign in Afghanistan has not been a brilliant success. How are we going to have a successful democracy in Iraq when we have never militarily intervened to directly establish a democracy anywhere else in the world?
Walter Russell Mead?
You know, there are a lot of assumptions in that question I have a tough time with. You know, by today's standards, I don't know whether you'd call Japan a developing country or, you know, we've done a lot of interventions. They haven't all been successes. Good. There's Haiti.
May I respond to that?
Well, why don't you give Walter Russell Mead a chance
to
talk?
And, you know, in any case, I mean, you know, those aren't necessarily arguments that's going to work. The intervention in Haiti has not, I think, led to paradise there. But I would argue that Iraq today is somewhat comparable to countries that in the past did make it into democracy, places like Italy. I'm somewhat optimistic that Iraqi society has a large number of educated people, very advanced in some ways, industrial and educational and social infrastructure. I don't know if we're going to succeed. I think it's very difficult. I agree with John Mearsheimer about this, but I think the possibility is there. I don't actually think the possibility for what we would call a democracy does now exist in Afghanistan. I see those as rather different cases.
May I briefly respond?
Very briefly, yeah.
Yes, certainly. Well, certainly, as I said before, the United States has never directly militarily intervened in any developing country to establish a democracy, whereas we have directly militarily intervened in various countries with our military or with our CIA to overthrow democracies.
Haiti was exactly a case that we intervened in.
Walter, I think to be fair, we have to let Andrew go now.
Let me finish, please. We overthrew a democracy in Iran in 1954, and Japan was not a developing country, and we did not intervene militarily in Japan to establish a democracy. We fought Japan because they attacked us.
Okay.
Again, I'm not sure that the point goes anywhere. The question is whether Iraq has the ability to establish a democracy now, and I think it probably does. Again, I'm not saying that we're going to succeed, but I think it's not an unreasonable hope.
Well, hopefully if they establish one, we won't overthrow it like we've done in so many other countries in the world.
Andrew, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Walter Russell Mead, John Mearsheimer, did you want to get in on that?
I was just going to say, we may establish a democracy, but we may not like what we get because the Shiites, who represent 60% of the population in Iraq, may dominate that government, and it may be actually an Islamic fundamentalist government similar to what you have next door to in Iran. So we better be careful what we wish for.
Mm-hmm. One of the other points that Andrew made in that, John Mearsheimer, was the talk of a timetable. We got an email from NJPM. I'm not sure what that name means, but there's all this talk of installing democracy in Iraq as though democracy was just a dress to be picked up at the store, put it on, and live happily ever after. On what basis can any rational person believe that all of a sudden democracy can be established, given that the thousands of years people in this area have never lived under a democratic system? Is it not reasonable to think, under the best circumstances, it would take several generations?
Well, I think, getting back to Andrew's question, that there is no timetable here, and it's not reasonable to expect the administration to have a timetable, because this is such a complicated problem that there's no way you can say you can do it in 3 years, 5 years. It's very hard to tell how this is going to play itself out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's quite clear that it's going to take many years just to reconstruct the place, and then many more years to create a viable democracy. Again, it's not even clear that we'll be able to do that, but there's no way that this is going to be done quickly. To put it in your words, this is definitely not a dress just waiting to be picked up at the local shop. This is a long-term endeavor. And the real problem that we're going to run into is that as time goes by, we're going to look more and more like a colonial power coming into an area in the developing world, especially in the Arab and Islamic world, and telling people how they should do their business. And we know from the past that countries in places like the Middle East don't like great powers coming in and trying to run their business. So it's going to create all sorts of problems for us.
Let's go now to David, who's on the line from Wynwood, Pennsylvania.
Yes, Neil, you're a gentleman, but you gave that first fruitcake caller entirely too much time to expound his theory.
We'll take a look at the video.
All right. My question for your guest is, my puzzlement, it seems clear from the actions of the Iraqi government in the past that they possessed weapons of mass destruction. There's no question, because they used them. We also know about the initial Israeli attack on the atomic reactor at Osirak in 1981, which probably had a tremendous impact on the limiting the loss of life during the Iran-Iraq war. And then the fact is that after he lost the war, caused by the invasion of Kuwait, Saddam continuously frustrated the efforts of the inspectors, which he had agreed to as part of that settlement of that. I mean, there were any number of times that the United States or the United Nations had the right to intervene militarily because he was simply failing to fulfill his requirements. We got used to this cat-and-mouse game. What I find most refreshing about the Bush administration, although I think it really was the 9/11 attack that focused everyone's mind on it, is that they finally used American power unapologetically to go after a rogue regime which clearly had ill intent toward us, and at some point in the future would have done something terrible to us.
So you don't need any more evidence?
Yeah, I don't see. I mean, yes, I would like to find the weapons. I'm hoping that these captured Iraqi scientists will help in doing that, but I don't see that's an issue. And clearly I would like to see Saddam captured, too, if only to have him stand trial. Mm-hmm. But that's not the essential point. The essential point now is that a major risk to the future stability of our world, the world is that we want to see preserved, has been eliminated. And that's, I think, we have great reason to thank the Bush administration for that. It may be that their program of democratizing Iraq is overly ambitious. It's going to run into problems. Nonetheless, I still think that what the situation we have today is better than what it would have been if this criminal Ba'ath regime had been permitted to continue in power.
Okay, David, thanks very much. Walter Russell Mead, I wanted to ask you, he is, among others, has mentioned Saddam Hussein. He is obviously out of power, but yesterday, I think it was, a newspaper in London published a letter that purported to be from him, calling on the people of Iraq to rise up and throw out the occupying powers. Is it important? Can it be a victory while he's still at large?
Well, I think it is, and, you know, as I said earlier, to some degree it is a victory now, and I think getting him would be nice, would be excellent, but and we probably will. But I think it's not as it's not the key. I think you've got to look at the big picture here. And if a year from now U.S. troops are largely out of Saudi Arabia, the Palestinian-Israeli peace process has moved ahead somewhat, and the U.S. has been very transparent. We're clearly not looting the Iraqi oil, and there is some movement toward a government, and it's fairly clear to people that the Iraqis, not outsiders, will have the final say in what kind of a government exists there. Then I think you'll have to say that the war worked.
John Mearsheimer, you had talked before the war that the policy of containment that had worked for so long after the first war in the Gulf could have been sustained, yet the difficulties of keeping the forces, Northern Watch at Incirlik in Turkey and Southern Watch based out of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, those can now be dismantled. As Walter Russell Mead points out, the difficulties caused by the presence of so many American troops in Saudi Arabia, not all of them are leaving, but the great majority of them will be. That's been eliminated. There have been some positive gains.
Well, I think there's no doubt about that. But the argument I would make is that you could have easily contained Saddam before without having troops in Saudi Arabia and without having no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq. He was just not that difficult to contain, and there was no need for us to have those massive forces in the Middle East to deal with him. We could have dealt with him quite easily with an over-the-horizon capability. So I'm glad those forces are coming out of Saudi Arabia. I've argued since the early 90s it was foolish to keep them there. But the idea that it was necessary to have those forces there to deter Saddam is based on the assumption that he's the second coming of Adolf Hitler and his army is the equivalent of the Wehrmacht. And this is laughable. He was a paper tiger, as we just proved, and as we proved in 1991. I mean, the Bush administration did a brilliant job of hyping him as this great threat, but he wasn't that great a threat, and we could have easily contained him.
Walter Russell Mead, an email from Simon Garcia. When a country declares victory in a war, what are its Geneva Convention obligations? Is the current administration likely to honor those, considering that it's stepped away from other international treaties?
Well, I'm no international lawyer, but my understanding is that by being an occupying power, we've already pretty much picked up all the obligations we would assume. We don't actually take on a whole lot more responsibilities by a formal declaration of victory.
But one of the obligations would be if you've got prisoners of war, if you declare victory, the war's over, you've got to let them go or charge them with something, I assume.
Well, again, that doesn't necessarily have to happen right away. There's all kinds of orderly provisions, and in fact, although it wasn't a particularly nice thing, Stalin kept German prisoners of war for 10 years after the end of the Second World War, reparations and so on. So, I'm no international lawyer, but I think the declaration of victory is not the essential point.
Okay. Our thanks to you both. Walter Russell Mead, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was with us from his office in New York. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And John Mearsheimer, Co-Director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. It was very good of you to join us again.
My pleasure, Neil.
We were talking about the possibility of the president's speech tonight. And by the way, you can hear coverage of that live on many of these NPR stations. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.